Case number 13-5203, Hanan Salah Rashid Abdullah, detainee, Camp Delta, appellant, Rami bin Saida al-Altabi, detainee, Camp Delta, Yusra Salah Rashid Abdullah, next friend of Hanan Salah Rashid Abdullah, appellant, versus Barack Hussein Obama, President of the United States, et al. Mr. Truitt for the appellant, Ms. Swindle for the appellee.
Mr. Truitt, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Steve Truitt. I represent the petitioner in this case. I'm accompanied by John Snodgrass, who is of Pepper Hamilton, who is pinch-hitting for my colleague Charles Carpenter. This is an appeal from a denial of an interlocutory injunction application, the petitioner is Hani Abdullah. He is a citizen of Yemen. He's been in prison at Guantanamo for over a decade. And the gist of the motion below was to enforce the terms of a Yemen recognition agreement, in particular as it incorporates the Geneva Conventions and other important aspects of international law.
Could we step back for a moment from the technical issues and just consider the question why your client would be better off asking for the habeas proceeding to proceed? You're at all interested in that would not be afforded by habeas if you win in habeas. And by the same token, if you don't win in habeas, it's hard for me to see anything useful that you can get.
The relief sought that is different is that he is presently held in violation of the Third Geneva Convention.
Well, if he's held in violation of law,
yes.
Habeas is a remedy to get him out.
No, not necessarily. There are intermediate remedies. That's quite incorrect. The interlocutory injunction granted in the Hamdan case did not grant paragraph 9 of his petition, which was for freedom. It granted an injunction against a trial by a tribunal that was improperly constituted. So when there is an ongoing violation going on, it's not enough to say, well, if we let you out.
Maybe I should put it more narrowly. What makes it illegal in your view is your contention that it's indefinite, relying on Professor Coe and other sources. And assuming that all to be true, it would seem to me that habeas is perfectly designed to get him out.
He's not getting out when hostilities are over. That is the point of the government's classifying him in a certain fashion, namely as too dangerous to release but can't be tried either. We have asked
back a moment. You assume that means that at the end of hostilities the government would continue to try to hold him.
Yes, that is what I believe is the case, and that's obviously what the UN commissioner believed was the case.
What is it that substantiates that?
Well, you can ask them.
Ask who?
But for one thing, the government, they're here. For one thing, saying that too dangerous to try, too difficult to try, too dangerous to release is, well, they're still dangerous when the hostilities have ended.
That may or may not be, without some indication from the government
I take the point, which is that with respect to the indefinite detention, there are two varieties in our view. One is the indefiniteness of the term before the war is over or hostilities have ceased. The other is thereafter. But with respect to that, you might reasonably find, when it happens, it happens. We'll take it up then. But that's not all the motion below was about. The motion below was about violations of international law, including the Third Geneva Convention. And these are not essentially contested. And I'd like to talk about two cases briefly. Well, first is Zivotofsky, and the second is Hahnemann. Zivotofsky kind of added to the jurisprudence of the recognition power. And it says, when the president recognizes a foreign nation and has certain terms that are part and parcel of it, it can't be interfered with. For the first time, I think, this court held, it can't be interfered with by Congress either. The leading cases in this had been Pink and Belmont, which said state law can't interfere with it. All right, so now we have a clear separation of powers issue. And that question is,
What's the interference? Is it the Military Commission Act that you're talking about?
Yes, okay. Exactly, Section 5. Okay. Section 5 says the court can't look in a habeas case to the Geneva Conventions as a rule of decision. Now, that's a direct conflict with incorporating international law, which, as Kieran points out, includes the law of war, and which Hahnemann points out was conceded by the Solicitor General, includes the Geneva Conventions. So they strip out the Geneva Conventions, and that stripping out is far more direct, I submit, than the somewhat tenuous.
So what is the violation of the Third Geneva Convention, according to you?
Well, we've listed them in the terms of the our brief. However, it includes such things as publication of the Geneva Conventions at the prison. It includes such things as having a prisoner representative. It includes such things as a freer kind of communication with the outside world.
So these are all conditions of confinement you're challenging?
Whatever they are, they're in the Third Geneva Convention.
Yeah, but can you challenge conditions of confinement in habeas corpus as opposed to release?
Well, that issue was pending in the force-feeding appeal, and the force-feeding panel said, well, here are these four cases that are in the circuit, the names of which I don't remember. One of them, I think, was Wilson, where conditions of confinement can be challenged and were challenged. Now, we don't know what is going to come of that. But, no, there is a prohibition, I would say. If the prohibition on conditions of confinement litigation interferes with the rights secured by the Geneva Convention, it's subject to the same argument that any of the other provisions are. That is to say, Congress has no power to displace the Third Geneva Convention. It is as though it was written into the executive agreement recognizing Yemen.
Counsel, you say at pages 3 to 4 of your opening brief, such relief, the relief asked for by the motion, would not necessarily end his detention, but would only eliminate one ground for it. So, I mean, that sounds like the most interlocutory of interlocutory appeals, because what it would be subdividing the habeas action, taking out a little issue, maybe a big issue, but certainly not the whole case, for a reading by this court, and then the habeas proceeding would roll on. That seems to be implicit in that sentence.
It is with respect to the indefinite detention claim. It is not with respect to the other contentions of violations of the Geneva Convention. They are separate. I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Ms. Swingle?
May it please the Court, Sharon Swingle for the Department of Justice, representing the government appellees. I think as Judge Williams' questions have alluded to this morning, every issue that petitioner raises here can be addressed in his habeas proceeding, and that is the appropriate proceeding in which to raise and litigate those issues. He has made, as the district court found, no showing of extraordinary circumstances that would warrant the kind of preliminary interim relief that he seeks here.
Do you know why this habeas proceeding is not proceeding?
We don't know, Your Honor, although I think it's not entirely correct to say it hasn't proceeded at all. The government did file both a factual return and then an amended factual return. And as I understand
it, when did that happen?
That was a number of years ago. He has filed several motions that are sub judice before the district court, and that's kind of the
same. How long have they been?
Since at least 2010.
Why has this not reached the merits?
I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor. Obviously, the government has been responding in a timely way to proceedings as they have gone forward. Mm-hmm. I think the district court has simply not moved forward acting on those motions.
Have there been any motions to the district court to adjudicate the matter?
Not from the government, Your Honor. Obviously, the petitioner...
From the petitioner?
Not that I'm aware of since the 2010 proceedings. And obviously, if he wishes to go forward with the habeas proceeding, the government stands ready to defend against that.
Do you agree that you can get a preliminary injunction in a habeas corpus action?
We do not, Your Honor. And I think he depends heavily on Hamdan for that proposition. Hamdan arose in a quite different and somewhat unique procedural posture in which the petitioner had claimed and sought relief because he argued that the government had violated the terms of an existing injunction in the case prohibiting his transfer. And so in the course of adjudicating that request, the petitioner's request in that case to compel the government to comply with an earlier injunction, this whole question of the propriety of military commission proceedings was
raised. Was it a preliminary injunction?
It was an injunction only in the sense that the petitioner there sought to compel compliance with an already existing injunction.
I took back, and I didn't do a lot, but I did in private practice, I did some habeas corpus cases, and I thought the only interim relief you could get, and I got in one case, was the conditional release.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, and as this Court's decisions have recognized, even that is an extraordinary remedy, limited to a very rare number of cases, effectively those, it appears, in which the petitioner would suffer irreparable injury and or the petition simply couldn't be adjudicated on the merits. And, of course, he's made no showing, either in the district court or in the Court of Appeals, that there are the kind of extraordinary circumstances that would warrant that type of relief here. And I think that in itself, as the district court found, is a reason not to grant the relief he seeks. I'd be happy to address the merits. I think there are...
Well, I have one question. He's being held until the end of hostilities. How does one define when hostilities have ended?
Well, I think neither the government nor the court has had yet to confront that. Certainly, we are still engaged in active hostilities in Afghanistan against the Taliban and associated forces. And as that is winding down, I think that question may be presented for the court. I think it's premature at this time. And I don't understand
Do hostilities under the authorization include countries other than Afghanistan?
I don't believe we have confronted that yet, Your Honor, nor do I think the question is properly raised.
If we withdraw all our troops from Afghanistan, I think the hostilities in Afghanistan would have ended, right? Because there are no Americans there.
Presumably, Your Honor, but again, I think it's simply not raised. And I would note that the petitioner here does not argue that there are not ongoing hostilities that would be a basis for detention under the AUMF, and that is the basis under which the government currently detains petitioner. I think we're having a little bit of difficulty understanding his argument because the task force determination was that he should continue to be detained pursuant to the AUMF while active hostilities remain ongoing. So I think to the extent any other kind of detention would ever be at issue, that involves some future entirely speculative set of facts that simply isn't presented yet.
As hostilities was not defined in the AUMF, was it? Was it limited to Iraq and Afghanistan?
The precise terms of the AUMF we reference in our brief, but my recollection is that it's the use of necessary and appropriate force against individuals who authorized, planned, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks or harbored them. And then there's, in addition, the definition of covered persons in the NDAA, which includes part of people who are part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces engaged in hostilities. So certainly to the extent we are engaged still in active hostilities in Afghanistan, that definition would come into play. And the AUMF, of course, recognized our active hostilities against al-Qaeda, and then, of course, the Taliban regime that supported and harbored them.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is hostilities is not, we haven't defined it yet, no. And it's not defined.
That's
in
correct.
So it can be
That's correct.
Anywhere in the world, and it doesn't have to be a declared war.
Well,
that's why
I think, again, it's simply, it's not at issue yet. I think this court did recognize most recently in its second decision in al-Makalah that there are still active hostilities ongoing in Afghanistan that would be a basis for detention there.
Counsel, what is, to the extent that the petitioner asks for the court to order an improvement in the conditions of confinement, what is the government's answer?
I have several answers, Your Honor. First, I think he has not adequately preserved any challenge to the conditions of his confinement under the Geneva Convention. He doesn't make the argument in his opening brief. He didn't, as I see it, make it in the district court. So to the extent he relies on provisions other than Article 87 of the Geneva Convention, I think that's waived. I think my second response would be whatever claim he might have under those other provisions, they are not that the types of claims that could ever be the basis for the extraordinary preliminary relief he seeks here. They simply wouldn't.
Well, when you get into conditions of confinement, I don't know. It's hard to see what limits there would be on preliminary condition, particularly with the habeas petition languishing for 8 years.
Well, certainly, as this court is aware, it's the government's position that conditions of confinement claims are not properly raised on habeas. But I would just also point the court to the precise violations that he charges, which are the absence of a camp representative, the inability to receive packages from home, and the lack of the publication of the Geneva Convention at Guantanamo. I think our position would be that even if those other problems didn't bar his claims, those would never be the kinds of violations that would be the basis for, you know, immediate preliminary injunctive relief.
Was he was captured in Pakistan, and according to some of the papers, there was a two-hour shootout before he was captured. Was he wearing a uniform?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
My memory of the Geneva Convention is it doesn't apply to individuals who engage in hostilities but without wearing a uniform. If they're not wearing a uniform, the Geneva Conventions don't apply. Is that right?
Well, certainly we've not taken a position on whether he would qualify as an unlawful belligerent not subject to the protections of the Geneva Convention. As we've said in our brief, we think the court doesn't need to reach that. I think that there are so many predicate problems with his Geneva Convention arguments, ranging from the statutory bar and the MCA to the fact that he simply hasn't made out, even on his face, a violation of the convention, that the court wouldn't need to reach that question.
He also relies on that Army regulation, right?
He does, Your Honor. I don't think it's entirely clear in what manner.
Does the Army regulation apply on a Navy base?
I don't know that we would take a position on that, Your Honor. I think we would simply note that to the extent that this court in al-Warafi applied Army Regulation 198 to find a right, it was quite a different kind of provision. It was one that on its face gave right to an immediate right of release. And, of course, the court ultimately concluded that no relief was appropriate there. I don't think he's pointed to anything comparable here.
Okay.
If the court has no other questions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Truitt have? Okay.
I could shed some light on Judge Randolph's question about timing. If you look at Appendix 2, you'll see docket item 293, or between 293 and 94, there's a minute order. It's hereby ordered, this was in 2010, that the petitioner's motion for a hearing be and hereby is denied without prejudice to refiling after resolution of the motions 93, 140, 148, and 232. We know who in whose power it lies to decide those motions.
The first motion
to have a declaration disclosed to us by
Which number on page 2?
Yeah.
No, it's page 2, but which one of the entries?
Oh, it's between 293 and 294.
I see. Okay.
Let's face it, the judge below has a terminal case of doing nothing. That's why we mandamused him to decide this issue, and that's why he eventually did, or rather promptly after the mandamus was filed, did so. With respect to Judge Randolph's...
Have you tried to get a, you know, a hearing on the habeas itself as opposed to...
Yes, we did that immediately. That's been ignored.
I'm sorry, immediately after what?
After like 2 weeks, we moved...
Oh, back in...
At the beginning.
After the initial filing.
Yes.
Okay. But you haven't renewed it since.
Nor has it been ruled on. With respect to the question of uniforms, I can report that my client was asleep in bed when he was seized, so he's obviously not wearing a uniform and probably never had. I suppose when the Solicitor General made no argument in Hamdan that Mr. Hamdan...
I thought he gave a statement to... He was interviewed and gave a statement. And I thought that the notes of that statement, I don't think they're classified, indicated that he was in a two-hour shootout right before...
No, there was a two-hour shootout around where he was.
Oh, but he
You're
was, he was sleeping during the shootout?
No, he woke up when the people came in and grabbed him. But now, with respect to the... Your recollection of the record's correct, but I mean, and he wasn't wearing a uniform, and neither was Hamdan. And no one ever suggested to the Supreme Court, this court, or the district court that Hamdan couldn't invoke Article 3 of the Geneva Convention because he didn't have a uniform on or some other aspect. Of the
well, situation. We held in Al-Oda that you don't get Geneva protection unless you're wearing a uniform.
And the Supreme Court held in Hamdan that...
They never addressed that issue.
That's correct. And why is that? Because... Article 3 applies independently of Article 4, and that is of the Geneva Convention. At least that is our contention, and there's some judicial support for it. And the holding of Hamdan is exactly that. Hamdan also disposes of this question of whether or not this was an interlocutory injunction. Of course it was an interlocutory injunction in Hamdan that was granted. It was interlocutory because it disposed of part of the habeas petition. And Article 9 of the Prayer for Relief asked for release. That didn't happen. All you have to do is go and read Robertson's opinion. It says the habeas petition is partially granted. Now, if that's not interlocutory, I don't know what is. There was no discussion in this court. There was no discussion in the court below. And there was no discussion in the Supreme Court about preliminary injunction standards. And we submit they're not relevant.
Counsel, is the argument at page 16 of your opening brief, the entirety of that brief's argument relating to conditions of confinement?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
Is the passage at page 16 of your brief, which alludes to conditions of confinement?
We didn't talk about the Geneva Convention.
No, I'm just talking about, forget about the...
We didn't talk about conditions of confinement, although what we're complaining about to be sure is. But that's because the Geneva Convention deals with them.
Okay, I understand. The question is the extent to which the issue was raised before us.
Well, the issue was raised
if the passage of page 16 is the entirety, the government certainly has an argument that it was not really raised.
Well, how does one raise it? I mean, we've put in our motion in the reply, below, we listed the sections we thought that were violated.
Yeah.
How does one raise it? I mean, that is what we did. Now, whether the court feels that was inadequate, that's up to them to decide. But I submit it isn't. Thank you.
Call the next case.